We need to see, we desperately need to see a turnaround in the met market. And we really haven't had any price discovery all summer. Like the cargoes that are, they're causing spot prices to move down. And you also have to keep in mind spot volume is maybe 3% of the global market. So we have traders and end users who are, you know, traders are reselling cargoes that they loaded up on, you know, ahead of Indian elections, for instance. Yeah. And then also around the Grosvenor fire, which occurred back on July 1, you know, that Anglo has enough tons at Grosvenor to ship through the end of September. So we haven't seen enough, you know, demand or purchases from, you know, from direct from producer to end user in the market to know really what the price of a, you know, a real cargo of new fresh mined coking coal really is. I think we will see that here over the course of the next month. And it'll, you know, put a four under.
Matt Warner, what's going on? How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Andy. How are you doing, buddy?
Doing good. Really good to see you. Last time we talked, it was about 2 weeks ago. You were on your way to Boston. I called you in your car. How was your vacation?
Much needed, really. But of course, you know, it was, my timing was impeccable because, you know, it coincided with the typical August rug pull in coking coal markets. And so, you know, there was much panic pretty much like right on the day that I left there. You know, so like I told people, it's pretty seasonal for this to happen. It's just that, you know, with China data as miserable as it sort of looks, you know, the weakness that I think most analysts kind of thought was going to come around in 2025 got pulled forward and got pulled forward really fast. So, you know, it's been, you know, a lot of playing catch up here. It's trying to get articles out whilst, you know, on the road on one screen and, you know, with a 10-year-old, little one, nipping at my heels too. So it was a struggle, but we got through.
Yeah. Texting and taking phone calls from guys like me. So
yeah. Yeah. Well, like I said, you know, I love talking about coal under any circumstances. So, so always happy to do that.
Yeah. Well, excellent. Great to see you. But let's start working that out. Yeah. Bad news in China, but it's interesting though. I mean, the charts are, I guess, in coal specifically, and please correct me if I'm wrong. They're down, but they're not. It could be so much worse is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
especially with the equities. Go ahead.
Yeah, it's, I mean, there's no two ways about it. Like the shoulder season has been an absolute wreck. You know, pretty much as soon as I think I tweeted out in January that the coking coal curve kind of looked long in the tooth. You know, that's, you know, whenever that happens, there's so much beta associated with the names, like you just have to, you know, kind of lighten up as shoulder season comes in. You know, I fully expected things to kind of bounce off the 225 level, and then they moved all the way down past it. You know, but strangely, it's not really a demand problem, which is the difficulty. It's a pricing problem, and it's specific to China. Their downstream demand has been pretty miserable on the real estate side. And, you know, they're still making a lot of steel. So they're importing, you know, more met coal than even I expected this year. Just the problem is that the steel price domestically has deteriorated so much, it's turned all those producers underwater. And the only way that they can get out from under that is to you call that steel out into the global market. And so now that there's a situation where, you know, India's begun to import some steel, which is kind of curbing the post-monsoon season coking coal demand I think a lot of us expected. Iron ore prices have been surprisingly resilient too, so that it doesn't, you know, clear up enough space in the cost profile of steel mills, you know, for coking coal to hang in here, which is right around, you know, current levels on the East Coast for the U.S. are right around mine level. We desperately need to see a turnaround in the met market. And we really haven't had any price discovery all summer. Like the cargoes that are causing spot prices to move down. And you also have to keep in mind spot volume is maybe 3% of the global market. So we have traders and end users who are, you know, traders are reselling cargoes that they loaded up on, you know, ahead of Indian elections, for instance. Yeah. And then also around the Grosvenor fire, which occurred back on July 1, you know, that Anglo has enough tons at Grosvenor to ship through the end of September. So we haven't seen enough, you know, demand or purchases from, you know, from direct from producer to end user in the market to know really what the price of a, you know, a real cargo of new fresh mined coking coal really is. I think we will see that here over the course of the next month. And it'll, you know, put a floor under the market, whether it's so the likelihood that you can see additional price declines without also seeing production curtailments over time. We've gotten to the point where that's pretty unlikely. And then similarly in Australia, you know, some of those mines can make money down to 175, 170, 165. But then the question becomes, much like Baowu said in their press release in China, you know, how much, you know, do you defend profits or do you defend your balance sheet? And I think that the, you know, if conditions continue to flag like this, you'll start to see production cutbacks. You'll start to see the market tighten itself. But, you know, the bottom line is the world's got to work through a pretty big glut of steel. And if we look back to 2014 as kind of the last time that a glut this big happened in China, it took about 12 months to 18 months to work through it. I think we're about 6 months in right now. So, you know, maybe another, you know, about another year's worth of weakness. I'm going to put that in air quotes. Yeah. To go. But well, you know, if China stimulates, then that's a slight game change, right?
Right.
If they try to, you know, induce, you know, downstream demand, if they make more EVs and export EVs, if they make more air conditioners, if they, you know, push the steel demand further downstream and export products, then there are some ways to sort of mitigate that we've seen them do here over the last couple of years. And, you know, honestly, we just have to wait and see. There's nothing in the third plenary session to, you know, for us to hang our hat on. It was almost identical to the last. So no mention of overcapacity, no mention of, you know, cutting back on that. So I think you just have to, you know, eat it here at this point. And that makes it difficult to really, you know, think about, you know, getting big in size for what we're still going to see, you know, a fall restocking season where prices should inflect. You know, the question is just how high will that go?
Right. A lot of stuff going on there. Let me just address first, like, obviously, like you just mentioned, China, if they were to stimulate again, but it's also the Fed. And again, we're not economists, but we are investors and traders, if you would. So if the Fed starts cutting again, that would be a stimulant, but also central banks around the world again, start the printing presses again. So just to stimulate growth, that would be obviously very beneficial for coal, and steel and met coal. So really my question is here is, obviously you said you thought we'd be bouncing around in here and then we're going into a good season, a restocking season. Mm-hmm. Where do we go from here? What you see, is this a place for investors to start accumulating again or just accumulate with caution not being raging bull or what?
Yeah. With caution right now, we desperately need to see a turnaround in the met market. And we really haven't had any price discovery all summer. Like the cargoes that are causing spot prices to move down. And you also have to keep in mind spot volume is maybe 3% of the global market. So we have traders and end users who are, you know, traders are reselling cargoes that they loaded up on, you know, ahead of Indian elections, for instance. Yeah. And then also around the Grosvenor fire, which occurred back on July 1, you know, that Anglo has enough tons at Grosvenor to ship through the end of September. So we haven't seen enough, you know, demand or purchases from, you know, from direct from producer to end user in the market to know really what the price of a, you know, a real cargo of new fresh mined coking coal really is. I think we will see that here over the course of the next month. And it'll, you know, put a floor under the market, whether it's, you know, 195, 190, 185. It's hard to say exactly where. The price is really meaningless until you get producers and end users actually transacting in the market.
Right.
You know, traders can't hold on to positions for very long. They're measuring, you know, like a lot of professional investors, they're measuring success on, you know, in weeks and months and quarters. Right. And if you get too far off sides, well, you got to cut your position. And I understand that, you know, that's it's not what I do. You know, I'm not a capital allocator. I do most of the, you know, my work in my 401k. So I'm, you know, short-term agnostic. But even, you know, even I'm not sizing up quite yet, at least on the names that are highly levered to coal prices.
Yeah. Got it. Let's talk about that then. It's, would you be hanging out in just really the bigger, stronger names? I'm assuming that would make sense as opposed to the smaller caps that seem to be a lot more speculative.
Well, I mean, right now, you know, when we think about the U.S. landscape, for instance, you know, you have AMR that's, you know, the buyback is off at the moment. You know, they're rebuilding their cash balance and, you know, and we're waiting on coking coal prices to turn. When they turn, AMR share prices are going to turn with it because that's how things work. You know, when you look at Warrior, you know, Warrior is very cost protected on the bottom line. You know, I want to say that Gulf Coast met coal prices are probably about 192, 193. And so, you know, that's a little bit of a discount to PLB, but, you know, every shoulder season, those relativities basically even out. So I think Warrior's kind of, you know, what you see is what you get at these levels. You know, I should probably mention that, you know, if we do have like a global recession or a real pullback in markets or anything like that, in those cases, all stocks go down. So
yeah,
coal's going to go down with them. And you know, me not being a macro economist, you know, I don't know whether that's necessarily on the table or not. Especially with interest rate cuts around the corner. It's a very kind of touch and go sort of moment. You know, we just had a merger between Consol and ARC. And so their buybacks are turned off for a few months as we're heading into thermal coal shoulder season. But Met begins to restock. So it's, you know, whereas I thought, you know, Consol would be an absolute no brainer, I think, for the back half of the year when I did the work on them, right around earnings, you know, they deferred a bunch of exports that we're going to make up for in the back half. I mean, they're going to have a massive cash balance when this deal gets done in, you know, in early 25, but, you know, until then, I think everybody's just, you know, market performing. There is one exception, I think, and that's BTU. I think Peabody's pretty quickly moved up to the top of the list. I mean, they have $100 million that they've dedicated, that they have dedicated to buybacks. We know they're going to put that out into the market on a VWAP basis. Yeah. And, you know, the Elliott overhang is done. And then Tobus Capital just initiated, you know, I hesitate to call it an activist position, you know, from my conversations. They're friendly. You know, they just want to see BTU communicate the messages that shareholders want to hear. You know, they want to hear about the shareholder return programs, maximizing value for assets, you know, whether or not they sell down a piece of Centurion a la Whitehaven here pretty recently. I think that's probably unclear. The real get over the longer term, which I think is a story that we all need to be talking about for a little bit, is the prospect of potentially building a new coal-fired power plant almost on a mine mouth basis, close to their PRB asset, and then pairing that with a data center or something. I think that's the kind of secret sauce that nobody really had that on their bingo card at the beginning of the year. But with power demand going, you know, rising at 3% per year, and, you know, demand for these data centers just going, you know, through the roof, I think it is incumbent upon the industry to find creative ways to participate in that uplift. And that's, it's almost like a call option on the PRB, which had been left for dead. So that I think is a long-term, very interesting, you know, narrative, at least, for Peabody going forward. And then separately, I think they're, you know, the Met operations in Australia are poised to do okay. The thermal coal operations are moving along well. Even the U.S. Mines are making decent. So I think BTU probably might be in the best position of anyone in North America here at the current time.
Well, I was going to jump into the stocks next, but let's work those out, flush those out. But let's talk about your story, though, and it's really, you said data centers, but you could even say AI centers. Yeah, if you would. I'm assuming that was either what you're referring to, or you could easily substitute that. Let's work that out. How long of a story is that? And those centers, if you would, are going up everywhere. So how, I know that's a copper play, but how is that also a coal play? And I'm asking
it's,
that really
early. It's a power, play. Yeah. So the more data centers that we build, the more baseload generation that we're going to need in order to meet it. You know, one of the struggles of the energy transition has been the inability of intermittent production to, you know, to scale in a meaningful way, you know, in function without baseload backup. And, you know, it's one thing if power demand's growing at, you know, 0.5%, 1% a year going forward. But if we're going to go at a multiple of that, you know, 3 to 6 times kind of a normal rate, we can't also be retiring baseload coal facilities at the same pace. So something along those lines has got to give. You know, there's been a resurgence around nuclear talks. I think we are going to get, you know, some new nuclear plants, whether that be, you know, a small modular reactor type of, you know, type of build out via, you know, NuScale or Oklo, you know, more traditional facilities. But, you know, we're not building enough gas plants, you know, and in coal, which had been left for dead. You know, it's my view that if we want to at all meet carbon emission standards for the energy transition over the longer term, we've got to figure out capture and storage. And we haven't had an excuse to do that at all, because the facilities, you know, aren't located necessarily next to storage, or you get logistics or transport involved and they suck a lot of money out of the supply chain as well. But you have a really interesting situation in Wyoming. And I talked about this with recently with Travis Detai, who's the president of the Wyoming Coal Association. In Wyoming, you have kind of a convergence of three things. You've got a lot of storage, you've got a lot of coal, and you got a lot of space and water. And you know, those things make a pretty reasonable interconnection too. That confluence of factors, I think, is pretty compelling to, you know, perhaps use some of the credits available under the Inflation Reduction Act to actually try to do carbon capture and storage at scale in a singular project for once. And then if we can prove that that works, you know, then the lid's off. Then we can think about instances where those confluence of events might happen and those factors might happen in other regions as well. But I think Wyoming is a great place to start it, because you got enough fuel and you got enough, you have support of the business community there and leaders. You've got a senator, ranking member on the Energy Committee, and John Barrasso. It's pretty interesting. You mentioned how long. I mean, this is going to be years.
Sure.
But you know, there's no time like the present to start on one of those projects. And I think, you know, I think there is a case to be made even to the progressive wing of the Democratic Party that we have to figure out all zero carbon generation potential. And if, you know, there's no reason why we shouldn't build at least one project paired with data center, so you offset demand, and then try to see if we can crack the carbon nut that way. Because we do. I mean, we can export that technology to the rest of the world, and it's a game changer for, you know, for developing economies around the world to the extent that they can store it. Sure. That's kind of how I'm thinking about it. And again, this is going to be a relatively long conversation, but I think it's one that we need to have just in general, you know, in the energy community.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I never thought of it as a copper. I mean, as a coal play, I thought of it as a copper play. But that leads me to ask you this question: would that be a thermal play or a met play for coal?
A thermal. That would be, you know, basically a call option on Powder River Basin production. You know, and then there are two big mines out there. There's Peabody's North Antelope Rochelle, and there's well, now Arch and Consols or Core Natural Resources, I guess, Black Thunder mine out there. That's a lot of production. That could be diverted to, you know, some pretty meaningful, you know, data center demand should, the parties be willing to accept it? That's a lot of cats to herd, but you know, on the political side, on the industrial side, and then on the producer and yeah. utility side as well. But you know, it's a worthwhile endeavor, I think, because you know the knock on effects of figuring that out would be, I think, pretty tremendous.
Yeah, you need to get people talking. It's also kind of, I don't know what the right word is, but just last time we talked, we talked about how the play was in met coal and thermal coal, not so much, especially here in the U.S., but that's a complete reversal of that.
Well, that one is, I mean, I think, you know, one of the comments I made last time was that, you know, thermal coal's pricing future is very much tied to natural gas and LNG.
Yep.
So, you know, to the extent that, you know, you think natural gas prices are going to outperform, thermal coal prices can function as well, you know, with regard, and there's a cost floor as well, you know, here domestically in the U.S. So, you know, you kind of, you're a price taker, I think, in the thermal coal market. Longer term on met, the thesis hasn't changed. It's just that we have, you know, a near-term risk in Chinese demand, and the world is going to have to adjust for that consumption here, you know, probably over 12 months.
Yeah. Good info. Mm-hmm. So let's talk some stocks here. You talked about Peabody, and I actually, I brought up charts, right before, but also a week before we were talking. And that was an interesting chart just because it seems to me that just the chart alone, it seemed to me like there's some really good value there. And it hasn't really gone much in 3 months, and that's really good considering the nature of things. But then you're telling me that the buyback program that they have, well, just tell me about that. And that would be very bullish for the stock. And again, this is not investment advice, but just
right.
You guys looking to.
Well, it's, I mean, the buyback's going to put a floor under it. Now, whether that's at $20 or $21 or $22, you know, maybe right. That moves up over time. But Peabody's been one of the easier companies to trade. I mean, if you pull up, you know, a Bollinger Band and an RSI chart on it, mm-hmm. I mean, when it falls below the bottom band, you know, usually RSI falls with it down to, you know, 40, 30, and you just buy it there and sell it when it hits the top. And you got, I mean, I'll just pull it back a year here. You've been able to do that
it's like a half a dozen times.
Four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11 times over the past year. you've been able to do that. And, you know, Peabody was a company that I started a position in, you know, a long while ago. And, you know, it got up to 30 and we all did a, you know, we did a celebration. And then, you know, with Elliott's overhang, it's just been, you know, straight down at a 45 degree angle. I mean, not very far. I mean, down 20, 22.
Right.
But it's been surprisingly easy to risk manage given it's relatively predictable volatility.
Right.
So for me, you know, I usually, I've sold puts on it just about every week for the last 2 years.
Season
one. And then just keep rolling it over. And then whenever they have a big move down, you know, two or three standard deviation move down, just, you know, start to size up a little bit into, you know, 4%, 5%, 6% range and then pull it back when it hits the top. That's kind of how I've been playing it over the last year. And it's been, you know, pretty low stress, to be frank. You know, my cost position is kind of zero at this point in time. So it kind of, I'm agnostic to what the share price is personally. But again, I think you'll see that volatility sort of continue, because it's really, you know, if you think about it from a liquidity standpoint, you know, if you're a larger fund or you know, a larger bank, this is really the only one you can get enough liquidity for to establish a position in size.
Yeah.
So, you know, the options market is really heavily active on it. You can hedge it easier than a lot of other equities. And that's a reason that it's bounced around, you know, pinballed around as much as it has. I've always thought that's almost an advantage for it. But obviously if you're more buy and hold long-term, it's been a frustrating hold to say the least.
Yeah. Well, I love that strategy. I actually use it all the time is also, but it has to be something you love or you want to hold long-term. If you would just sell some puts to get a put to you.
It is, It has been annoying.
Yeah.
It's been pretty annoying and a lot of work to sort of hold on to over that period of time. But now, you know, I do think they're moving into a completely different environment with the buyback underneath them, with Elliot gone, with an activist who's, helping, I think probably going to help management communicate the things that we want to hear. And, you know, to the extent that, they're motivated and incentivized to participate, I think we'll have, speculatively speaking, I think we'll have a pretty good next couple of years, despite, normalization in coal markets.
Got it. Let's talk about the big player, AlphaMet. Again, they've sold off quite a bit. They had a great buyback program that you mentioned on our previous talk. That's been, I don't want to say suspended, but no longer happening. I guess that would be a buy when they announce, or when you expect them to announce to start buying back stock. And they'll do that when the stock gets really cheap or cheaper relative to what they think it should be.
I think on earnings calls, they've talked about, having a $300 million cash balance as kind of a goal overall. They hit that last quarter. Even where coal prices are, they're going to make money this quarter. You know, it might not be a whole lot, but they'll be cash positive. I think probably if you see that number get up to $500 million, cash balance, $600 million cash balance, you'll see it probably come back on. It's a guess on my part, but more importantly, I think right now is that, AMR is a company that I know over the longer term, provided that the long-term met coal thesis remains intact, is going to have an incredibly bright future, just because there aren't many shares traded. I think average daily volume is like maybe 200,000 shares. So, we've had this, 50% drawdown in price on comparatively little volume relative to prior, happenings. But without the buyback putting a bid under it, we're back down here at 225. For me, thinking 2 years, 3 years, 4 years down the road, I like it at, I liked it at 400. I like it at 350. I like it at 300, 250, pretty much whatever level. But, we're still just not in a period where you can confidently size up a met coal position and expect to really have a good go of it. For me, it's like, I need to see the met coal price turn, and I need to see either some sort of China stimulus or China, improvement in downstream demand before I feel comfortable getting up to, 5, 6, 7, 10% position and then riding, this wave up to, when I typically, rebalance quarterly in like January, February or something like that.
Got it.
Yeah. So it's, wait and watch. It's fine. I tend to buy a little bit whenever I put money into the 401k. And again, that's the only vehicle I have really to do, any long-term, investing in size with. You got to be patient with it, and you got to be patient with the market, and stick with it. And over the longer term, it'll be fine. But I think if you needed to size up a coal position today, they're probably better avenues.
Got it. Talk to me just really briefly about Warrior. We talked about them last time. Same thing. Just tell me your thoughts. Just wait and see.
Warrior is one of those companies, again, over the longer term, we know it's going to be $120, $130, $140 stock at least. Blue Creek comes online, within the next 12 to 24 months in pretty decent size. The narrative has done very, very well for it. Everybody understands that Alabama has a cost advantage relative to the rest of the U.S. just because of transport.
Right.
And the quality of the Blue Creek coals get a slight premium over what you typically see for like U.S. East Coast low vols. At times in the past, it's been, Blue Creek coal has been interchangeable with PLV. So market participants are more willing to pay premium for the higher CSR coals, like number 7 going forward. Now, Blue Creek is high vol A coal. It's not, it's not low vol, super high, CSR production. So eyeball as time goes on, it's going to wind up reverting to kind of historical discount, the low vol, which is usually about 15%. If you think about volatile content for coking coals, low vols are typically about 20% volatile matter. So you heat it up in a coke oven, 20% of the mass gets driven off as gas, right? Mm-hmm. High vols are in the 30 to 35% range. So that delta, that 10 to 15% delta in the past has typically been the price discount that you see on high vol A's. I think over time, you know, as Blue Creek comes on and you know, potentially if Longview ever returns to the market, although not sure quite whether it's an A or a B, but the more high volatile material you have in the market or semi-soft, the generally bigger the discount that you'll also see. So, you know, with that in mind, you know, I think Warrior is in a great position, call it by 2028 to be, you know, again, like 120, 130, 140. We should be on the right side of the price cycle by that time. But in the interim, you know, you have to watch, you know, the beta of met coal prices, and kind of judge that according.
Right.
Well, I'm comfortable, you know, accumulating it at 60 or 55 or 50. But again, if we get a position where, you know, the market sells off, or if China data deteriorates further, I mean, you know, you can't be surprised if it heads a little bit lower than, you know, from here in the short term. So, you know, all of these things really depend on, you know, your listeners' time frame and how they're measuring their own success in that sort of thing. And, you know, it's something I probably don't talk about enough on Twitter, just because, you know, I have other clients and things like that, but, you know, we do get to kind of expound on those things here in longer formats. I just want to make that.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Any, again, not specific to a company, but anything that's interesting that is new and in the small cap space. And again, not specifically company specific or ticker specific, I should say, but are you kicking around some tires or, seeing what's out there?
Well, I mean, there are a couple of things, that I think we might see here over the next month or so. I mean, really the only things in the meth space that we have coming up, the only kind of events or catalysts are we have U.S. domestic settlements that should come out here over the next few weeks. With prices globally at or near what are mine level costs for the higher quality material, you know, the low volatile coals, you know, if I were a domestic producer, I would be concerned about production cuts, particularly from undercapitalized, you know, smaller producers in Central Appalachia, you know, small 100 to 300,000 ton a year operations. Those are going to be the first ones to sort of fall by the wayside in terms of production. So if I'm a domestic U.S. steelmaker, I want to lock up as much low vol as I can at a price that is going to ensure that that supply will be there next year when I contract. I don't know if that is the prevailing sentiment amongst end users, mm-hmm. but you know, if I were advising them, I'd have some concerns about future availability. If you don't provide a price that will ensure their well-being for at least the next year. So, you know, not necessarily saying that U.S. domestic producers should, you know, pay a hefty premium for high quality domestic tons, but, I think they should, you know, maybe consider 170, you know, 165 low vol at the mine, which would, you know, if you take that out to the port, would imply like a $230 per ton average of coking coal for the coming year, which, you know, is still plausible. The curve's at about 225, right? I think that's where people ought to set their marks. And I wouldn't suspect that, you know, if you were to do that, you could probably settle pretty quickly. Now on the high vol side, I think the numbers are probably going to come down relative to last year. High vol, I think last year settled around 145 for B coal and maybe 150, 155 for A. It was probably come down by $5 or $10. But, you know, when you pull it down by 20, all of those mines come up against their cost profiles too.
Yep.
So So again, this is, you know, in a similar fashion to how coal producers, you know, were sensitive to steelmakers' needs last year, as, you know, when they did these settlements, there was a looming UMWA strike, or not UMWA, I'm sorry, United Steelworkers strike. There was some uncertainty as to how much they'd be able to produce. And they got a pretty good deal for the year. You know, the average price that they paid was well under what the global average was, you know, over the course of this year. So, you know, I think to, you know, a little reciprocation, you know, for the next year, probably wouldn't be such a bad thing. So that's kind of the, what I'm looking to see here over the next few weeks. It might work out differently, but companies that are levered more toward domestic production, you know, from a ticker standpoint, you know, it'd be interesting to consider. I think you could probably think a little bit about Corsa down here, CSO.V, which is the only, you know, real microcap that we have in the coal space. But they sell, you know, 70% of their production domestically. And if they get a pretty reasonable price, you know, 155, 160, they get a little discount because of their sulfur content. And they can get their costs under control down to like 130, 120, somewhere around in that area. They were 150 last quarter. Got a ways to go. You know, that they could wind up having a really interesting 2025. And, you know, they have some debt that they need to pay off. They'd be able to do that. And I mean, I don't know if they're quite ready for shareholder returns, but certainly would be able to, you know, return to, you know, reasonable prosperity and put some money in the bank. So that's kind of an interesting one I'm thinking about.
Got it. Yeah. I was checking them out before our talk as well. And they had a really good, I want to make sure I say this right. They had a good sell off. Their chart looks interesting if you're a value investor.
Costs are the issue up there. You know, they have one mine that they really need to bring on. And, you know, in order to, at Kaiser, to really lower the overall cost profile of the company. And they're not well capitalized enough to do it yet. I don't think, but it's one that I've got on the list there, and we're kind of waiting and watching. And, you know, I sized it up last year, and then cut it in August when they got this windfall settlement from Pennsylvania Department of Transportation. But it's back down to levels where, you know, I think you at least got a head scratch a little bit and see how things work. It's a fun little one to take a look at.
Yeah. So build your list, everybody. Start building lists at the very least. Well, Matt, I'll end on this. Is you have a great following on YouTube and Twitter, but I want to say this too. I was surprised, not really surprised, but I was surprised just how many people request updates, interviews. Let's hear from Matt. I don't know if that's because you were on vacation or whatever, but, you know, a lot of people enjoy listening to you, enjoy your work. So I wanted to give you that. And I'm going to let Trader Ferg, let him know and send him this interview. I'm sure he'll really enjoy it. So, just want to thank you. One of the best in the industry, well, the best in the industry in coal, and one of the kindest, most honest, I think, analysts out there. So I just want to thank you for that, Matt.
Well, thanks, man. I mean, you know, it's been a pretty wild, you know, sort of middle of my career here. You know, as I think I told you last time, I didn't really expect to come back around and be, you know, a full-time coal analyst, you know, at any point in time over the past 8 to 10 years. You know, I diversified up the chain, up through iron ore and steel, and then did base metals, precious metals, and, you know, battery metals and uranium and all kinds of different, commodity markets, you know, in order to kind of hedge my bets, you know, and here we are where this commodity has just become, you know, really vitally important around the globe. And even though we're on the, you know, the back half of this, you know, of this current cycle and this last price run, it's just, it's been such a blast to, you know, kind of rekindle friendships in the industry. And, you know, like I said before, like I'm happy to be, you know, a representative for the industry and an independent voice for it, because the industry's gotten such a bad rap over the last decade.
Yeah.
And there's so many fantastic people involved in it. You know, I just want nothing but the best for them. And, you know, and for these great companies that are creating jobs in my home state of West Virginia. So it's hard for me not to be biased, you know, in that regard, because we want all these guys to succeed. And you know, and we're still, you know, very much focused on long term, but, you know, it's just been a privilege here to be in this position here for the last little bit. So grateful for your viewership, obviously, and for everybody else who tuned in.
No problem. And it's very well deserved. So thanks, Matt. It's always a pleasure. I'll have you on and again in about 3 months. We'll see where the market's at.
Anytime. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.